Helping Children Succeed, What Works and Why, by Paul Tough. A struggle imposed by adversity. Kids who are growing up in poverty or other adverse circumstances can be difficult for teachers to reach, hard to motivate, hard to calm down, and hard to connect with. Those who seek to overcome these educational disparities face many obstacles, some financial, some political, and some bureaucratic. But the first obstacle is conceptual. We don't yet entirely understand the mechanisms behind childhood adversity. What is it that growing up in affluence provides to children that growing up in poverty does not? The role of non-cognitive skills. A group of factors often referred to as non-cognitive or soft skills play a role in the challenges poor children face and the strategies that might help them succeed. These qualities such as perseverance, conscientiousness, self-control, and optimism have in recent years become a source of intensifying interest and growing optimism among those who study child development. Many people now believe that they are critical tools for improving outcomes for low-income children. Teaching non-cognitive qualities. As the value of non-cognitive skills has become more widely acknowledged, demand has grown for a curriculum or a textbook or a teaching strategy to guide us in helping students develop these skills. But rather than considering non-cognitive capacities as skills to be taught, we came to conclude that it's more accurate and useful to look at them as products of a child's environment. If we want to improve a child's grit or self-control, what we need to change first is his environment. The environment effect, stress. Adversity, especially in early childhood, has a powerful effect on the development of an intricate stress response network within each of us that links together the brain, the immune system, and the endocrine system. Especially in early childhood, this complex network is highly sensitive to environmental cues. It is constantly looking for signals from the environment to tell it what to expect in the days and years ahead. When those signals suggest that life is going to be hard, the network reacts by preparing for trouble, raising blood pressure, increasing the production of adrenaline, heightening vigilance. On an emotional level, chronic early stress can make it difficult for children to moderate their responses to disappointments and provocations. Small setbacks feel like crushing defeats. Tiny slights turn into serious confrontations. In school, a highly sensitive stress response system constantly on the lookout for threats can produce patterns of behavior that are self-defeating, fighting, talking back, acting up in class, and also, more subtly, going through each day perpetually wary of connection with peers and resistant to outreach from teachers and other adults. On a cognitive level, growing up in a chaotic and unstable environment and experiencing the chronic elevated stress that such an environment produces disrupts the development of a set of skills controlled by the prefrontal cortex, known as executive functions. Executive functions, which include working memory, self-regulation, and cognitive flexibility, are the developmental building blocks, the neurological infrastructure, underpinning non-cognitive abilities like resilience and perseverance. They are exceptionally helpful in navigating unfamiliar situations and processing new information, which is exactly what we ask children to do at school every day. When a child's executive functions aren't fully developed, those school days, with the complicated directions and constant distractions, become a never-ending exercise in frustration. The parental effects. The first and most essential environment where children develop their emotional, psychological, and cognitive capacities is the home, and more specifically, the family. Beginning in infancy, children rely on responses from their parents to make sense of the world. A crucial role parents play early on is as external regulators of their children's stress, in both good ways and bad. When children's caregivers respond to their jangled emotions in a sensitive and measured way, they are more likely to learn that they themselves have the capacity to manage and cope with their feelings, even intense and unpleasant ones. Our premises. One of the premises we're working from here is that childhood is a continuum, and if we want to help improve outcomes for disadvantaged children, we need to look for opportunities to intervene in positive ways at many different points along that continuum. There's overwhelming evidence that early childhood, the years before a child's sixth birthday, and especially before her third, is a remarkable time of both opportunity and potential peril in a child's development. Children's brains in those early years are the most malleable, more sensitive than at any other point, to influences and cues from the surrounding environment. The neurological infrastructure is being formed that will support all children's future capacities, including not only their intellectual abilities, but also those emotional and psychological habits and abilities and mindsets that will enable them to negotiate life inside and outside of school. The effect of the environment is amplified during those early years. Parental interventions. Parents who are under a lot of stress because of poverty or other destabilizing factors in their lives are less likely than other parents to engage in the kind of calm, attentive, responsive interactions with their infants that promote secure attachment. But what excites many researchers today is that emerging understanding that those behaviors can be learned. It appears to be relatively easy to support and counsel disadvantaged parents in ways that make them much more likely to adopt an attachment-promoting approach to parenting. Outside intervention programs, Educare. The premise behind Educare is that kids from disadvantaged backgrounds need two things in order to eliminate that gap. At age 3 and 4, they need a high-quality preschool that provides them with a solid grounding in letters and numbers, as well as a stable base of interpersonal, motivational, and psychological capacities. But first, before they set foot in preschool, they need to spend their first 3 years in an environment with plenty of responsive, warm, serve-and-return interactions with caring adults. And if they can't get that at home, they need to get it at a place like Educare. The complicated nature of incentives and motivation. Within the field of psychology, Edward Deci and Richard Ryan, two professors of psychology at the University of Rochester, argued that we are mostly motivated not by the material consequences of our actions, but by the inherent enjoyment and meaning that those actions bring us, a phenomenon labeled by intrinsic motivation. They identified three key human needs: our needs for competence, our need for autonomy, and our need for relatedness, meaning personal connection. And they contended that intrinsic motivation can be sustained only when we feel that those needs are being satisfied. Deci and Ryan say that when students can be encouraged to internalize those extrinsic motivations, the motivations become increasingly powerful. This is where the psychologists return to their three basic human needs. When teachers are able to create an environment that promotes those three feelings, they say students exhibit much higher levels of motivation. Why punishment fails. Our usual intuition when children and adolescents misbehave is to assume that they are doing so because they have rationally considered the consequences of their actions and calculated that the benefits of misbehavior outweigh the costs. In fact, one of the chief insights that the neurobiological research provides is that the behavior of young people, especially young people who have experienced significant adversity, is often under the sway of emotional and psychological and hormonal forces within them that are far from rational. School discipline programs might be more effective if they were to focus less on imposing punishment and more on creating a classroom environment in which students who lack self-regulatory capacities can find the tools and context they need to develop them. The effective classroom paradigm. Because we tend to talk about school performance using the language of skills, we often default to the skill development paradigm when considering these qualities. Teachers teach new non-cognitive skills. Students learn new non-cognitive skills. Those new skills lead to different behaviors. Here's a different paradigm. Admittedly imprecise, but we would argue, a more accurate representation of what is happening in effective classrooms. Teachers create a certain climate. Students behave differently in response to that climate, and those new behaviors lead to success. Did the students learn new skills that enabled them to behave differently? Maybe. Or maybe what we are choosing to call skills, in this case, is really just a new way of thinking about the world or about themselves. A set of attitudes or beliefs or mindsets that somehow unleash a new and potent way of behaving. The first step. Helping children in adversity to transcend their difficult circumstances is hard and often painful work. It can be depressing, discouraging, even infuriating. But what the research shows is that it can also make a tremendous difference, not only in the lives of individual children and their families, but in our communities and our nation as a whole. It is work we can all do, whether or not it is the profession we have chosen. The first step is simply to embrace the idea, as those researchers did, that we can do better.